We're reading this morning Canto 3, Chapter 15, Text 31. And that's all right. We had a discussion yesterday that was left up in the air a little bit, based upon reading this verse. So I'll read the verse. The question is, when the Kumaras were trying to enter the seventh gate of Vaikuntha and Jayan Vijay stopped them, at that particular point in time, were they bhaktas with bhakti for the Lord, or were they brahmavadis with Brahman realization and in one sense worthy of not being allowed to enter Vaikuntha because they weren't yet in a mood of devotion to the Lord? And the confusion, or the uncertainty came specifically in terms of how Prabhupada translated this particular verse, text 31. So we'll read the verse. Translation. When the Kumaras, although by far the fittest persons, were thus forbidden entrance by the two chief doorkeepers of Sri Hari, while other divinities looked on, their eyes suddenly turned red because of anger due to their great eagerness to see their most beloved master, Sri Hari, the personality of Godhead. So, the way that it's been translated by Srila Prabhupada here, eagerness to see their most beloved master, Sri Hari. So, makes it sound like they're in Dasya Rasa, or at least as bhaktas, viewing the object of their devotion. And if that's the case, they certainly were eligible. But later on, where the question was, were they, so, text 43, this is text 31. Text 43 specifically says, when the Lord came, because of the incident, wind came, a breeze came from, Vaikuntha has breezes too. And the tulsi buds at the lotus feet of the Lord were carried, the fragrance of them was carried. Text 43. When the breeze, carrying the aroma of tulsi leaves from the toes of the lotus feet of the personality of God, had entered the nostrils of those sages, they experienced a change, both in body and in mind, even though they were attached to the impersonal Brahman understanding. So this is where the event takes place. They were attached to the impersonal Brahman understanding. Purport of text 43. It appears from this verse that the four Kumaras were impersonalists, or propagandists of the philosophy of monism, becoming one with the Lord. But as soon as they saw the Lord's features, their minds changed. In other words, and it explains how that happens. Because of the fragrance of his lotus feet carried by the air and mixed with the aroma of tulsi, their minds changed. Semicolon. instead of becoming one with the Supreme Lord, they thought it wise to be devotees. Becoming a servitor of the lotus feet of the Lord is better than becoming one with the Lord. So at this moment, then it's quite clear, they weren't devotees. Here's some from Nectar of Devotion, chapter 9, which is titled Further Consideration of Devotional Principles Under Smelling the Incense and Flowers Offered to the Deity. Mention is made here. It is stated in the Tantra Shastra, quote, if the smell of the garland which was offered to the deity in the temple enters into a person's nostrils, immediately his bondage to sinful activities becomes cleared. Even if one has no sinful activities, still by smelling such remnants of flowers, one can advance from the Mayavadi, parentheses, impersonalist, from Mayavadi to devotee, unquote. There are several instances of this, a prime one being the advancement of the four Kumaras. They were impersonalist Mayavadis, or at least Brahmavadis. But after smelling the remnants of flowers and incense in the temple, they turned to become devotees, which happens in verse 43, not in verse 31. After smelling the remnants of flowers and incense in the temple from the lotus feet of the Lord, they turned to become devotees. So twice it's they turned in here in this 43, they became transformed. Their mind and body changed. They experienced a change. Their minds changed. So, what's happening here then is Prabhupada's bhakti. That's one thing that's happening. And the Lord's position is the Lord's position whether they were recognizing that position or not recognizing that position. In other words, for the devotee, for the non-devotee, and for the impersonalist, regardless of our consciousness, Krishna is our dearmost friend. Suradam sarva dehinam. Sarva dehinam. He's the dearmost friend of all living entities who are embodied. So that's the non-devotee embodied, the devotee embodied, the impersonalist embodied. He's the dearmost friend. So a reading of what is being said is their position was impersonalists, wishing to see that person who, not necessarily they were having affinity towards him as their dearmost friend, but he is their dearmost friend. And to help support that, I want to read Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's commentary. You have it? What's that? Okay, fantastic. Text 33. Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's translation and commentary. The wise gyanis. Okay, so this is now text 32 and 33. This is the Kumaras speaking to Jai Vijay. So the Kumaras said, what is this irregular nature of yours exhibited amongst the inhabitants of Vaikuntha who have natures like the Lord's? achieved by intense service. The Lord is peaceful, devoid of a fighting nature, but you, cheaters who think everyone's cheater like yourselves, mistrust everyone. Text 30, there's commentary. I'll read the commentary. Quote, because they were afflicted with anger, they first criticized the doorkeepers. Among those who have qualities similar to the Lord's, tat dharminam, living close to the Lord, what is this irregular nature of stopping brahmanas from entering in opposition to the Lord's nature? Response. But enemies of the Lord, disguised as brahmanas, try to enter Vaikuntha by deceit. We should question them first and then allow them to enter. Response by the Kumaras. No, you too are deceitful, pretending to be devotees. You are enemies of the Lord, showing disrespect for brahmanas, lack of peace, and a fighting nature. You alone in Vaikuntha should be distrusted by the Lord. Thinking that the whole world is like yourselves, Atmavat, you cheaters mistrust all others, but you alone are not trustworthy. Pretty heavy. So text 33, this is the part that this is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's rendering of what's going on, what's being said within the Sanskrit translation. The wise Gyanis, this is the Kumara speaking, do not see the jiva to be different from the Lord in Vaikuntha, who holds within his abdomen the whole universe. Just as the air in a pot is not different from the great sky, for what reason do you fear the safety of the Lord? That's the Kumara speaking. Commentary. Now he's, in the first part, he's paraphrasing what their message is. Fools, please listen. Those of you who mistrust are within the Lord, for the whole universe is within him. The wise Gyanis do not see difference between all jivas and the Lord. Here in Vaikuntha, there's a message of oneness, by the way, who holds the jivas within him, just as the sky in the pot is within the great sky. For what reason do you, dressed as devotees, fear that someone will come and pierce the abdomen of the Lord? Please tell us that first. And then he explains. Actually, the consciousness of the jiva with its nature are meager. Actually, the consciousness of the jiva with its nature of meager dependent knowledge differs from the consciousness of the Supreme Lord, endowed with unlimited auspicious qualities such as his inherent omniscience, like the difference between the heat derived from the sun and the sun itself. For speakers who are Gyanis, that's the Kumaras, they're not devotees, Gyanis, in the line of Gyanis, the example of the great sky to explain non-difference of the Lord and the jiva is not inappropriate, since persons who want to realize impersonal Advaita Gyan accept only one spiritual substance and reject existence of distinct spiritual beings, parentheses, such as the Lord and the jivas, and the gunas of maya. So he's not equivocal. It's unequivocal. They're from the platform of Brahmagyan saying, and from the previous verse, that they have Brahmagyan, specifically their when Prabhupada has translated Atma-tattva, he's translated as knowledge of the self. Vishwanath is translated as they were Brahman realized. They were attached to the impersonal Brahman. So the meaning of a word needs to be understood, like anything, it needs to be understood in context. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary is squeaky clean, really clear. They were Brahman realized. They were recognizing that the Lord respects the Brahmanas, and you don't have that capacity of representing the Lord properly. So, you don't belong here. You belong somewhere else. You belong in the material world. And just a little detail. Suvrittama is this operative. This word. He who is most dear to everyone. That's describing the Lord, as opposed to, it could be read how they were viewing the Lord, or how the Lord is viewing them. The Lord is viewing them as he's the most affectionate, most dear to all, including the Kumaras. So here's his translation. Being forbidden to enter by the two, this is text 31. Being forbidden to enter by the two doorkeepers of the Lord, while the devatas of Vaikuntha were watching. Did you know there were devatas in Vaikuntha? The way the Prabhupada has translated it is, and other exalted persons. So, why not? I mean, for persons who are assisting the Lord to maintain the spiritual world that he's maintaining and manifesting, and they get some service to do. They're not... he's independent and they're just doing some service. So, exalted persons doing some exalted service. Like the previous description of the very qualified devotees who are the pilots of the Vimanas. What does that mean? Does it mean like, you know, the passengers were kind of second class and they were first class? Servitors? It's just they're given some responsible service. Something like that. The devatas of Vaikuntha were watching. The most deserving Kumaras' eyes suddenly filled with slight anger because of their desire to see the Lord was thwarted, spoke. The way the Prabhupada has explained it is like a child. You know, a child's wandering here and there. It's not because, you know, they're great devotees, the children, and they want to go behind the curtain on the altar and see Krishna. They want to go anywhere they want to go. They don't want anybody to check them going anywhere they want to go. So like that, they wanted to go. And they were being checked. And they became angry, both surprised and angry. So, I will read Srila Prabhupada's report. Oh, that's over here. According to the Vedic system, a sannyasi, a person in the renounced order of life, is dressed in saffron-colored garments. This saffron dress is practically a passport for the mendicant and sannyasi to go anywhere. The sannyasi's duty is to enlighten people in Krishna consciousness. Those in the renounced order of life have no other business but preaching the glories and supremacy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the Vedic sociological conception is that a sannyasi should not be restricted. He is allowed to go anywhere and everywhere he wants. And he is not refused any gifts he might demand from a householder. The four Kumaras came to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana. Listen carefully. The word Suhritama, quote, best of all friends, unquote, is important. As Lord Krishna states in the Bhagavad Gita, he is the best friend of all living entities. Suhridam sarva bhutanam. No one can be a greater well-wisher, well-wishing friend to any living entity than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, reading it carefully, the term is describing the person, not so much the regard that Kumaras have for the person. He is so kindly disposed towards everyone that in spite of our completely forgetting our relationship with the Supreme Lord, he comes himself, sometimes personally as Lord Krishna appeared on earth and sometimes as his devotee, as did Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and sometimes he sends his bona fide devotees to reclaim all the fallen souls. Therefore, he is the greatest well-wishing friend of everyone. And the Kumaras wanted to see him. Not necessarily because they were bhaktas of the Lord wanting to see him. In fact, they were gyanis. But they were Brahman realized and they didn't want to be restricted. The doorkeepers should have known that the four sages had no other business, meaning like this paraphrased way that Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur is saying, we're not in disguise, so-called brahmanas sneaking around trying to enter Vaikuntha and make a problem for the Lord. You know, what's wrong with you? So they had no other purpose. As the previous purport, text 29, says, they were not duplicitous. They had no other purpose. Therefore, to restrict them from entering the palace was not apt, appropriate. It was bad. They made a mistake or an offense. Then the rest of the purport is about anger. In this verse, it is figuratively stated that the younger brother of desire suddenly appeared in person when the sages were forbidden to see their most beloved personality of Godhead. The younger brother of desire is anger. If one's desire is not fulfilled, the younger brother, anger, follows. Here, we can mark that even great, saintly persons like the Kumaras were also angry. But they were not angry for their personal interests. They were angry because they were forbidden to enter the palace to see the personality of Godhead. Therefore, the theory that in the perfectional stage one should not have anger is not supported in this verse. Anger will continue even in the liberated stage. These four mendicant brothers, the Kumaras, were considered liberated persons. But still, they were angry because they were restricted in their service to the Lord. The difference between the anger of an ordinary person and that of a liberated person is that an ordinary person becomes angry because his sense desires are not being fulfilled, whereas a liberated person, like the Kumaras, becomes angry when restricted in the discharge of duties of for serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead, bearing in mind that they weren't devotees yet. Last paragraph. In the previous verse, it has been clearly mentioned that the Kumaras were liberated persons. Viditatma tattva is the Sanskrit phrase, means one who understands the truth of self-realization. Vidit atma tattva, they're in knowledge of Brahman. One who does not understand the truth of self-realization is called ignorant, but one who understands the self, the super self, their interrelation, and activities in self-realization is called viditatma tattva. Prabhupada is taking some liberties here, elevating the real standard is the knowledge of the knowledge that's contained within bhakti. Although the Kumaras were already liberated persons, they nevertheless became angry. This point is very important. Becoming liberated does not necessitate losing one's sensual activities. Sensual activities continue even in the liberated stage. The difference is, however, that senses in liberation are accepted only in connection, sense activities in liberation are accepted only in connection with Krishna consciousness, whereas sense activities in the conditioned stage are enacted for personal sense gratification. So if you want to look something up, you're okay. So we discussed this a bit yesterday evening about the appropriateness of anger. It has its, in summary, it has its place. Transcendentalists may become angry. In scripture there's examples, in the lives of our great acharyas there's examples. If we exhibit anger, it's a sign of something that's different than if a transcendentalist exhibits anger. And a transcendentalist exhibiting anger, like, here's one example, it's in the Bhagavatam, when Arjuna heard that Ashwatthama had killed the sleeping sons of the Pandavas, he became very angry. The place where it's describing the eyes, I can't recall, became copper red. The Krishna or his devotee? I can't recall. In any case, first canto.
Krishna's eyes were red, but they were described still as lotus petals, and Arjuna's eyes were described as copper red or fire red or something like that.
Mm-hmm. There are times when exalted devotees, it's appropriate for them to exhibit anger. I've shared this before, it just seems appropriate to share it here. On one occasion, at our Henry Street Temple in Brooklyn, I was in like this close to Prabhupada as he was exhibiting intense anger. The circumstance was what is now the BBT at that time was called ISKCON Press, and ISKCON Press was operating from the Brooklyn Temple. The devotees lived in the temple, and then they went to another facility on Tiffany Place, some blocks away, where they, because it was inexpensive, where they could perform, you know, get produce Prabhupada's books. And one of the areas was the art department. So when Prabhupada would come, comedy was once a year, he would come, and the artists would bring their paintings, and they would show, I'm sure there was some other exchanges, they would take photographs and send the photographs to Prabhupada, and, you know, things like that, but they brought their art, you know, the full, with the frame and the whole thing, and brought before Prabhupada. So there were a whole lot of artists, and they needed some help, so we helped carry the paintings into Prabhupada's quarters, and we're sitting in Prabhupada's quarters. And it was a time where their service for the whole year was being recognized. So it was important to them, and Prabhupada gave due importance to acknowledging their service, and some, you know, the exchanges were just very loving. Sometimes he would speak something about the technical feature of the painting. Sometimes he would tell a story. Sometimes he would make a joke. And, you know, it was just all very warm and loving exchange. It was like lots of laughter and very, very jovial. Right in the midst of it, Prabhupada reached and pressed the buzzer that was underneath his desk. And you couldn't hear the thing ringing, but it was ringing to tell his servant who was in across the hall in the room down the hall to come. So here we are with this joyful situation and lots of laughter and mirth and happiness. And in comes the servant. And the servant paid his obeisances, and right in the middle of paying obeisances, Prabhupada's voice thundered. And I don't know what, I can't remember what he said because I just blanked out. I was shocked. And he said something, you know, in a really loud tone of voice. And the devotee was, you know, duly chastised for whatever it was that Prabhupada was chastising him for. Paid his obeisances and left. And then Prabhupada resumed the conversation as if that hadn't even happened. And I found out later there was this person who was Prabhupada's servant was having a big spiritual problem. He was doing some very bad things. I had no idea what was going on. Prabhupada knew what was going on, and he was bringing him back to his right consciousness, but he did it, you know, with force. Because he loved that devotee. He didn't want the devotee to be in such a horrible condition of maya. So he used that which, by inspiration of super soul, he knew would be appropriate for that devotee. And after I recovered from what just happened, and here's another little detail. Not detail, it's an appreciation of Prabhupada. Being in Prabhupada's presence was wonderful. And the way that Rupanuga described it once is that Prabhupada exhibited the quality of heaviness, because Guru, one of the meanings of Guru was heavy. So when Prabhupada would laugh, the whole room would laugh. Sometimes he would tell a Bengali joke that nobody understood except him. And then he would laugh. And then we didn't understand what the joke was, but everyone, we just were carried by the mood of laughter. And when he became very angry, his mood carried the persons in his presence because of his position. Not only our regard for him, even non-devotee people were moved by his moods. So it was very light and, you know, wonderful, joyful, ecstatic, and then thunder! And then happiness, and just like that. So I realized Prabhupada is not just heavy because he thundered, but heavy because it's his quality. And then another was that he used anger I thought about it this way afterwards. It's like he had a sword, and he took the sword out of the sheath, and he showed the sword, and then put the sword back in the sheath. He wasn't controlled by anger. He was using anger in Krishna's service. Because our experience is, when we become angry, it takes quite a while to like simmer down from that mood of anger, because we're controlled by it. And it's not the same as using anger. Like that example of Hanuman using anger. He was sitting on the wall contemplating what he should do. Should he just go back now that he's found Sita and he gave Ram's ring, and you know, so she knows that she's okay, Ram is coming. But he wanted to go one more. And then, so it was a decision, and with that he did what he did. And then when it was over, when Lanka was burning, he's sitting on the shore. And he's not like controlled by anger, burning in anger, and you know, boy, I got them, yeah. He was, you know, just contemplating peacefully what the next move was. And how, and his service to Ram. Like that. If anger is to be utilized, it should be utilized where it's being utilized, not as utilizing you. You're not controlled by anger, you're utilizing it in an appropriate manner in service to Krishna. That's ideal. If one can has that capacity, you can use anger. If not, don't be used by anger. Any discussion? Go ahead.
I realize there's something wrong. It seems when you say reading and explaining it, it felt like there's a difference between how liberated persons deal with anger and how devotees deal with anger.
You got it. Not just so the liberated persons deal with anger by using it. Non-devotees or non-liberated persons become controlled by anger. Rather than use it, they get used by it. They're controlled by the modes of nature. That's the difference.
But liberated and devotees, is there a way they use differently? Like pure devotees use anger at the right time and they're not controlled by it and they use it.
Mm-hmm.
And liberated persons also same, or they're something at lower level in some way?
I don't know the distinction that you're making. I wasn't making such a distinction. One of the points that Prabhupada makes is that specifically for a devotee, a devotee's anger shows that sensual activity is appropriate. So the mind is one of the senses, the sixth sense, or 11th sense, the knowledge acquiring working senses in the mind. So utilizing the senses and utilizing the mind is part of bhakti. Now, he just went there without making a compare and contrast like you're asking for an impersonalist. Although we know clearly now from these commentaries that they weren't in the bhakti position, they were in the gyan brahmavadi position. And they became angry. Now, how that works isn't explained for the impersonalist liberated soul. How it works for the devotee is explained. Something.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about sentence Prabhupada writes, becoming liberated does not necessitate losing one's sensual activities. And in other places Prabhupada writes, so we hear about how we're always sentient. And sometimes it feels like devotees behave in such a way that sometimes they seem to think that one was more advanced, like it's not supposed to have any feelings,
sure.
And it just like so insensitive, and it makes me angry.
And so, where do you go with that?
And so, maybe in the past I showed more anger. No, I don't. But yet, it's like they want to feel included and serve and, you know, just so on. And sometimes, it's like, they do things in a damaging way, whether relationships or deep service or this or that.
You heard what I said yesterday. I'll say it again. It's appropriate. I'll say it in a different way. As a rule of life, better to err on the side of caution than so. For us, who are not liberated, we're devotees, but we're influenced by the modes of nature. This is something that I mentioned in one of the classes. Having a discussion with some of my god brothers on the topic of beginning the devotional service is a process of transcendence, and we're pulled by the transcendent and the process of transcendence, and in that perfected stage, the modes of nature are no longer operating. But in the path of transcendence, until that stage of perfection is achieved, we are influenced by the modes of nature. So to be influenced by anger in that transition phase, it has to be very carefully managed. And part of the discussion is, okay, one way of looking at this is, the discussion that we were having was, what kind of an organization are we? Is it a transcendental movement, or is it a movement that's governed by varna and ashram, or a blend? And if it's a blend, to what degree is it a blend? So, if we just go by the transcendental, then get angry. And it's fine because it's for the service of Krishna. Just get angry. And then, okay, well, where's the line? Do I have to have a qualification? No, I don't have a qualification. Just get angry because it's in relation to the service of Krishna. That doesn't sound right, because we're influenced by the modes of nature. There's a mix. So where does the line go? So one of the persons in this conversation was saying, this god brother Sannyasi, was saying, I know I'm not free from the modes of nature, and those that I'm interacting with are not free from the modes of nature, and so we need some kind of a structure to guide our activities for those of us that are on the path of transcendence but not free from the modes of nature. And then, okay, so that's not specific to anger, but it's a frame of reference that should guide our activity. And at what point should something be checked, like anger? At what point should something be exhibited, like anger? So there's the feeling of anger. So to what degree is that transcendental feeling? To what degree is it a modes of nature feeling? Probably it's a mix. Now, should I exhibit it or should I curtail it? Not suppress it, but, you know, redirect it in some other form or fashion. Seems to be the question. That's not only the question you're raising, it's a question of what should our social behavior be when there's transgression that's interfering with the teachings and the standards and the purpose of our Krishna conscious lives, our devotional service to Krishna.
And especially when something has been taught so many times and it's like repeatedly done, then it feels more difficult to balance it.
A short answer to a complex question, a subtle. Different circumstances require different things. So, in some cases, being very, very strong and firm, not necessarily anger, but strong and firm, sometimes that's necessary. Because in certain circumstances, it's not going to be understood any other way. It may not even be understood that way either, but it's not going to be understood any other way. It's necessary. But there are other responses to a circumstance like that that may be more effective and more appropriate. So really, the deciding factor should be what's going to be effective and appropriate for the circumstance. That requires purity to be in the position where I don't have to do one thing, I have options. And then another is, because I'm in that detached position, I can see a number of options instead of one thing. And then I have the discrimination to be able to evaluate what's appropriate, what's not so appropriate, what would be better, what would be less effective. And then selecting from the menu one that's appropriate because of the circumstance and the effectiveness that the selection will bring. So when one is inexperienced, that takes a lot of time. And when one is more experienced, having done that a lot, the scan can take place pretty quickly. Because one is, it's like anything that you learning how to type on a typewriter or play the harmonium or something. There's some practice, and after some practice, it's very easy. It's real easy. But, while you're just learning something, it goes very slowly. So err on the side of caution advice is, rather than, there's only one option, and that's two options. Just keep it to myself, or let the person hear in a tone that, because they've heard it nicely so many, many, many times, and it didn't go anywhere, so now let me say it, in a different tone. And because there's only one option, that or just keep, saying it nicely, or just give up. Three options. So there's multiple options. And considering when one thinks about the welfare and of others and the appropriateness of what might be effective, Krishna gives intelligence about the whole situation more than if one just acts. So it takes purity, it takes practice, it takes experience, it takes a super soul connection, guidance from super soul, how to act in the circumstances of life are all different. What's appropriate? What's going to be effective to expand Krishna's service done nicely? Anything else? Yes.
A question, but off topic.
Off topic. Go.
Other day you were mentioning how, from your own experience, when you increase the number of rounds of chanting, like you were, then
keep
the bodily needs diminish.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the same thing can happen for everybody, but that's what happened.
That is very inspiring. The principle is very inspiring. When the spiritual intensity increased, the bodily demands reduce. But how do we also get there without imitating, but trying to follow in that principle?
Little by little. What's important, little by little, what's important is sustainability, something that you can do and it's sustainable. So there are different ways of little by little. Let's say one, a Vaishnava way is on auspicious days like Ekadasis and appearance days you do something, or Kartik you do something, and you do for that, you know, you do it carefully. And then the next Kartik or next Ekadasi or something like that. Then that gradually increases capacity, spiritual capacity, and decreases bodily necessity. That's the principle of Ekadasi, increase, decrease. Good? Okay, thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya.